To read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel. Spoiler alert, it involves a lot of hard work and quite a lot of luck. I'm Mark Stay, and before we jump into this week's episode, a big, big hug and a thank you and a cup of tea and a biscuit to our wonderful sponsors at Scrivener. Scrivener is the official writing app of the Bestseller Experiment. Both myself and Mr. DeVoe love it, and we love it because it's so adaptable. We've used it on all sorts of projects since writing Back to Reality. I've been using it on screenplays, I've been using it on other novels, and I've been using it just to compile research and stuff. It's incredible. Really, really adaptable. You can get a 30-day free trial if you pop over to literatureandlatte.com, and if you want to buy a copy, then tell them we sent you. Put in the code BESTSELLERXP when prompted, and you, dear listener, will receive 20% off. That's BESTSELLERXP. Go do that. Now, this week, I was delighted to speak to the wonderful and warm Veronica Henry. Veronica is a Sunday Times top 10 bestselling author, and she's had an incredible career. She's written for The Archers on radio. She's written for Holby City on TV. And then she started writing novels, and she was rather good at it. She won the RNA Novel of the Year Award for a book, A Night on the Orient Express. And she is just an incredible writer and very knowledgeable. And one of the nice things about interviewing her, I sat her down. Now, this is what happens when we get an author on the show. We tend to sit them down and say, this is what the podcast is about. These are who our listeners are. And she said, I know who you are. I just wonder what's taken you so long to ask me on the show, which was quite gratifying. So yes, Veronica, we talked to her about all sorts of stuff. We talk about, now, a lot of her books are about families and extended families and the dramas and dilemmas within that. We talk about family trees. It's something we haven't really covered before on the show, which is where, if you're protagonist, do they have that father, a mother, a brother, a sister, cousins, aunts, uncles, that sort of thing. So we talk about family trees, how far you should go with that kind of history, and the excitement of when a random third cousin comes in and shakes things up. We talk about the editing process and editors, and we play backlist bingo. We do talk about The Archers, writing for The Archers and writing for TV. Now, there may be some international listeners who don't know about The Archers. The Archers is a BBC radio soap opera, drama, continuing drama about the life of farming folk in the UK. This is a British institution and it's been running for decades. And to write for a show like that really is an honour. And Veronica tells us what she learned about that in the conversation that you're going to hear right now. Veronica Henry, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. I've had a lovely day here at Orion Towers. So champagne and cake, so...
Why the champagne?
Oh, just general love for each other.
I think there's another reason, because a few words have appeared at the top of your new book, A Family Recipe, on Amazon, and the words say Sunday Times top 10 bestseller. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Absolutely thrilling and very exciting and lovely. So yes, that is why.
Tell us about A Family Recipe. Where did the book come from?
I always start with a location. So I decided I wanted to set it in Bath, which is where I went to school. And I always want to take my readers somewhere that I think they'd like to inhabit for the duration of the book. And I know people love Bath because it's exotic and beautiful and, stunning architecture, and it's just a lovely place to be. So I started with that. Then at the same time, I found a small recipe box that's been in my family for generations. It goes back to my great-grandmother, I think. And I just thought it was a very relatable little thing that probably lots of people have in their kitchen. One of those little things with index cards in that has your brownie recipe or your scone recipe. And I thought that was a sort of starting point for a story. And then when I was researching Bath, I found out that it was very heavily bombed over two nights. So there was the Bath Blitz. And I was quite surprised that I didn't know very much about it. And I thought, actually, that's really interesting, something, that would add another layer to the book. So it's two timelines. It's half set in the Blitz and half set now. And the little recipe box is the kind of thing that ties the two things together. It's the family recipes that hold the characters together.
That's fantastic. Starting with the location is an interesting one. I mean, you live in, from what I can see from your Twitter and your Facebook, one of the most beautiful places in the world. Yes. That must help.
Yeah, I think it is the best beach in the world. By TripAdvisor, I think, decided that.
When you're out and about, are you constantly taking notes? Are you thinking of story locations, story ideas? What you went to school in Bath, but was it a return journey that took you there, made you think, ah, there's a story here?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm always looking for somewhere new, and I like to set it in places where people could actually go. So I'm not doing the Caribbean, which is sort of slightly out of people's reach, possibly. I'll do something that, you know, if people read that book, they think, oh, actually, I think I'll go there for the weekend or something. So, and Bath, I went to boarding school there and absolutely hated it and swore I never wanted to see Bath again. But of course, now I'm a grown up, I can see the attractions. And, you know, it's, you know, so many people go there for long weekends, hen weekends, Christmas, the market at Christmas. It's a very beguiling place. So that's kind of, and you know, just full of stories.
So you've got your location, you've got your recipes. How do you start piecing together a story from that?
Gosh, it's kind of like a collage, I suppose. A setting does not a story make. That's the first thing. But it is I have to know the place. And then I start thinking, who lives in a place like this, as Lloyd Grossman would say. And very often the house is the next thing to come out of it, because I write very much about families. So I'll choose a house. And then I'll think, well, who, you know, which generation am I writing about? Do they have children? Who is the family? And what's the inciting incident? Why am I going in through that front door? Why do I care about these people? And what's happening to them that's going to sustain me over, you know, 100,000 words, basically? You know, there's got to be a lot going on. So it is inevitably crisis points that I walk in through the front door.
Right. Well, you're putting together a family. How far do you extend that family? Do you build a little family tree? And when do you think, okay, I'm up to the great, great, great grandparents, let's just stop and concentrate on the story?
Yeah, you do have to kind of rein it in, because, you know, while we all have extended families, and there is Auntie so-and-so, and you can't confuse the reader too much, so you have to focus in. But family is also what makes it rich, and you know, that extra character that walks in through the door is the person that will throw everything into chaos. And funnily enough, it's a combination of planning that, and then when you start writing, you know, they always say people are either plotters or pantsers, and I'm sort of both. So I have a structure that I set the sat nav, but then you do actually have to start writing, and that's when the magic happens, and that's when the random third cousin suddenly steps into the room and goes, actually, and then you think, oh my god, that's really exciting. And that's what the wonderful thing about writing is, when you suddenly get butterflies and everything slightly gets turned upside down. Right. Yet you still have to keep to your original structure, but it adds texture and richness and variety.
Fantastic. Earlier in the little love-in with the champagne and everything, you mentioned your editor, Harriet, and you said lovely things about Harriet. Now, it kind of escaped your attention that there was a lot of furore online last week featuring Anne Rice. And it's quite an old post that Anne Rice put online, saying that she didn't want comments from her editor anymore. She was basically self-editing. Her editor could just basically be a mentor. Where do you stand on that sort of thing? Because I think you find editors to be very important, do you not?
Extremely. I mean, writing books is teamwork. I spent a lot of time writing television. I was a script writer before that, so I'm very used to writing collaboratively. Mm-hmm. And although it's the writer's name on the front of the book and you have kind of masterminded it all, to suggest that other people haven't contributed to what ends up on the shelf is kind of arrogant, I think, and unrealistic. And possibly, you know, you might maybe need to have a bit of a check on your quality control, because for me, an editor is the person that is reading your first draft or whatever as a potential reader. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've lived with that book for a long time, so you understand the story, but you may not have made it totally apparent. So your editor's coming along and being that objective opinion. But also, particularly in the case of Harriet, she is just brilliant at spotting the weak points that I might have glossed over, or just the kind of that extra layer or that extra plot twist that will make the book richer, deeper, more exciting, more compelling, more page turning. And it's really hard to do that yourself on your own work. I don't have the ability to stand back and look at my work and be objective about it. Mm-hmm. And it's just lovely to have another talented person thrown into the mix to make it. And, you know, I'm not so up myself that I think I don't need help or guidance. And I don't think that somebody else can't make it better. They absolutely can and do.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's your procedure when the email arrives and it has the file in there and there's, I mean, certainly whenever I've written anything, there's hundreds of little changes and comments. What's your sort of triage? What do you fix first?
Oh, I have to go away and think about it. So the initial set of notes, what's also great about Harriet is she's not prescriptive. She'll just say, I think it needs this, but I know you will find a way to do that. Right. So I have to go away and find my way of doing it. I'm not very good if somebody comes along and says, you have to do this in chapter 6, because it doesn't work. It has to go through my sort of brain process, and I might have to come at it from a slightly different angle. So it needs to percolate. I take those notes and I read them over and over again and think, what does she mean? What does she actually really mean? And then I come up with a solution, and, you know, for all the different points, and keep referring back to the original notes. And sometimes the solution I come up with will address the notes, but in a very different way. But I know that Harriet trusts me and I trust her, so that's fine. And mostly it works. We're quite a good team, I think.
Yeah, we've heard this before, that you, and certainly you find this with maybe first-time novelists who are getting notes for the first time. They feel, oh, I have to do exactly what they say, otherwise they'll burn the book and I'll never be published again, kind of thing. But you use those notes very much as a jumping off point and get inspired to do something that's your own story.
Yeah, but also I've had years of being savaged by television script editors, so I don't really care. You know, I can take criticism, and I think that is a massive thing that writers have to learn to do, learn to take notes and learn that it's not personal. It's all about making it better. It's not about saying you're a shit writer.
Yeah. Is there... In your experience, have you found a way of discerning what the good notes are and what the not good notes are?
They're always valid, I think. And I've got enough confidence that if I disagree, you know, there was a particular note in the book I've written just now, and I disagreed with it, but I worked very hard to underpin what I then did in order to convince Harriet that my way was the right way.
Yeah.
And that wasn't being arrogant. It was just that I just firmly believed, and I think she's been persuaded. I might not agree with her notes, but it doesn't mean they're bad.
Maybe you had an intent and she didn't get it, so you felt, I just need to reinforce that intent.
But also people have different life experiences, and I just had to find a way of reframing that to make it relatable to her. And clearly at the time I'd written it, it wasn't clear enough. So it's like, okay, I have to work really hard to make this better.
Now I'd like to play a game, if that's okay. I'd like to play backlist bingo with you. So would you like to pick a number between 1 and 10?
Okay, let's go 6.
Now this isn't a book.
Oh,
it's a TV show.
Holby City. Yes. Okay, so I was on the writing team for Holby City a few years ago. It's extremely challenging because you're writing a combination of serial drama. So there's characters who are in every episode, and it's a kind of, there's a sort of cliffhanger. It's a serial. So it's not, but at the same time, there are guest stories within that hour long episode that are self-contained. So it's sort of a hybrid of two different types of drama. And then you've got the medicine to throw into the mix. So you're having to write a convincing story relating to the patients, the guests, that has a kind of medical journey. But obviously, so the drama has to take place in the right place. You know, you have to be in the right surgery. You can't be in the cardio ward if your patient has got appendicitis. So it's a very logistically difficult show to write because you have huge restrictions about where each of those long-running characters are. So your CT nurse has to be on the CT ward. She can't just be having a chat with another nurse from another ward. And if she is, there has to be a reason for her being there. Right. Really complicated, really fascinating. We have medical researchers who help with the the medical background, but it is a real, you know, you're picking up the long-running stories from a previous writer and then handing the baton on to the next person. So it's so many balls in the air. So actually writing a book after writing an episode of Holby City is easy peasy.
Do you get a series bible for something like that as well?
Yeah, you would do. If you join the team, you'd kind of get a breakdown of the, you know, last 6 months episodes so that you're across all the main characters' stories and what's happened and what, you know, what's happening in the hospital. Because Holby City is also, it's the same hospital as Casualty set in. So, yeah. And you have to be up to speed. But they've got script editors that will check the continuity, and you are given a storyline. So you're given a storyline, but also you have to come up with your own guest stories through which the main character stories are told. So it's... Okay. It's kind of unique, really.
Yeah, the family tree must be a breeze after taking in the series Bible and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Okay, pick another number, please.
4.
1, 2, 3. Oh, it's another TV. Ah, no. The Archers. Now, tell us about this.
Well, that was my first job when I got kicked out of university. I went and did a typing course, and then somehow miraculously was taken on by The Archers. I was a production secretary, and it was just the loveliest, the nicest thing I've ever done and been paid. It was just brilliant, because who doesn't love The Archers? And it was crazy. So although my job was predominantly to type the scripts, it used to take 2.5 hours to type out an Archer script. But I'd also be in the studio for 2 weeks every month watching the whole thing come to life. And so it was a real privilege. And that's where I learned that everybody needs an escape. Everybody needs to switch off, and everybody needs to go somewhere else, because, you know, people are all over the country are just sort of turning to Ambridge for 15 minutes, you know, immersing themselves in somebody else's problems, love lives, ups and downs. And it's just, it's wonderful. And that's where I thought, right, I want to be a storyteller. Right. Yeah, so that's...
It must have been a great education.
Oh, it was, because I worked for William Smethurst, who was a great storyteller, and he could weave a story out of nothing. So one of his best plots when I was there was who stole the over-60s tea money. And, you know, that doesn't sound like a storyline, but it, you know, ricocheted through the village, and the suspicion and the kind of, you know, everybody denying it was them. And that's where I learned it doesn't have to be about huge things. It's the human interest, and it's the character-based stuff, and the little things that have impacts on how we behave that are important in storytelling. So it was, you know, it was brilliant working for him. It was fantastic.
That's amazing, because you often hear, particularly if you're writing scripts or movies, well, tell me about the stakes. What are the stakes? What's at stake? And of course, if it's the tea money, that doesn't sound like much to you or me, but to these characters, this could be the end of the world.
Well, yeah, exactly. It was huge. And, you know, and actually, I don't even know who did steal it, but it went on for weeks, and it was just brilliant, because you'd get little thumbnail sketches of each personality and how they reacted to it. And that was and, you know, just the fact that The Archers is still going now and is more popular than ever just proves that those sort of everyday stories of country folk are that's what we kind of want: familiarity and rhythm and nostalgia and escape. So that was my masterclass. That was my, absolutely.
Had you been writing before then?
No. I kind of went there. I was 20, I think, when I walked into Ambridge. I'd always been good at English at school and things like that. But William gave me opportunities. I think my first bit of script writing was, we used to do road shows, and I'd write scripts, and members of the audience could come up and record a scene with their favourite Archer's character. So I wrote those little scenes, and that was my first foray into radio drama.
Fantastic. What a place to start. Pick another one, please.
Oh, 7.
I've lost top of that. A Night on the Orient Express. Now, you talked about location.
Yes. I'd kind of run out of seaside, Cotswold, countryside. And actually, this is the one example of exotic locations that aren't particularly cheap. And I just thought, where can I set my next book? And I don't know where it came from. It just popped into my head. And I do know that somebody else has written a book set on the Orient Express. But I just thought, how fantastic. You know, you've got a journey, you've got an enclosed space. And the other thing about the Orient Express is people are on there for a reason. You know, they're not just going to from London to Venice. There's usually a birthday or an anniversary or a secret tryst and that kind of... And it's so romantic. And who wouldn't want to go on the Orient Express? So I just thought, right, that's where I'm taking my readers. And it was fun. And it was quite challenging because it's not a long journey. It's 24 hours. So I was having to write a story set over 24 hours, also in an enclosed space. Mm-hmm. And I kind of fairly quickly realised that that's quite challenging. But I sort of enjoyed that. And again, having come from a script writing background where you have got a lot of restrictions, I was sort of used to being hemmed in by what I could and couldn't do. And it was brilliant. It was great fun. And
did you take the journey yourself?
Yes, I kind of had to. It is magical. It is, you know, you are being transported somewhere else. And you do sit in that train carriage and think, oh, he's quite a bit older than her. what are they doing on here? So you can't not sit on that train and start telling yourself stories or speculating. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, glorious.
Wonderful. Wonderful stuff. Another number, please.
Oh, my goodness. Three.
I've lost count of what numbers we've picked. So, now this is an interesting one. This is Sea Change. But this is part of the Quick Reads. Quickly explain what the Quick Reads promotion is.
So Quick Reads is something that's supported by the Reading Agency. And it's they basically publish 6 books a year by kind of mainstream authors. But they're short. They're kind of 20,000 words, which is probably about the fifth of the size of a usual paperback. And they're designed for people who aren't confident in reading, may have not read until they're an adult, who are new to literacy. So they're used quite often in prisons to, you know, help people to learn to read or become more confident. Mm-hmm. So it's a big literacy drive, basically. And I was very honoured to be asked to write one. I can't remember how many, probably 4 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that, you know, they're a complete book in themselves, but they're structured quite simply. So the chapters will be fairly short. The vocabulary will be not too complicated. So not too many words of long syllables, quite not complex sentences.
That must be quite a challenge, though.
It absolutely is. People assume that writing a short book with easy sentences and words is a breeze, but it's not. It's you have to be, you know, because you still want the story to be exciting and engrossing and page turning, but you have to be mindful all that time of that person that might not be that comfortable with reading. So you're just kind of holding their hand, really, and drawing them in. But it's just so lovely when then you meet somebody who has. I can remember meeting. I went up to Scotland and did a few libraries. And meeting a woman, and that was the first book she'd ever read. And the way her eyes shone, it was just, my work is done. It's just, it was wonderful to know that she hopefully had gone on and read more books.
Right.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Pick another number, please.
Ooh, let's go for one.
One. Uno. Ah, The Birthday Party. Not a Harold Pinter adaptation.
No, it isn't. That was a sort of fun celebrity putting the microscope on a celebrity family. So it's slightly different to my usual, slightly more glamorous and a bit more heightened. It's so long ago now that I can't remember the actual plot, but there's much bad behaviour. Much bad behaviour.
Was it based on any particular celebrity family, or have the lawyers advised you to keep strum on that?
You know, I can't possibly. You'd have to read it and work it out for yourself.
Okay, so it's a woman with a Hellraiser husband.
It's all, it's a kind of big conglomeration of every celebrity family that you know and love, but with a bit of extra, you know, naughtiness thrown in.
I think we'll do one more. Pick one more.
Okay, 8.
Wild Oats. Tell us about Wild Oats.
Oh, okay. So that I used to live in the Midlands, and my favourite place to go for the weekend was Ludlow, which is back in those days, we weren't surrounded by gastropubs and artisan this, that, and the other, and, you know, wonderful food. And Ludlow was very much at the forefront of, I think it was had at the time, the most Michelin-starred restaurants in one town in England. I think it had three, maybe. So it was just a fantastic place to escape to. And it's called, you know, it's kind of half red brick Georgian and half black and white timber. So it's a really lovely mix of architecture. So, of course, you know, perfect setting for a Veronica Henry novel.
Yeah. Location again.
Yes, exactly.
I'm going to cheat. I'm going to pick, I think, now let's. What was your first one? Is it Honeycoat?
Yes.
Right. I want to talk about Honeycoat, okay. Your first one, how that came about.
Okay. So I had been writing television for a long, long time. My first love was always books. Mm. And when you write a script, you don't go into great description. You're not allowed to be endlessly sort of loquacious about what people look like and what the houses look like. And that's what I missed. That's what I wanted to do. So I decided I'd try writing a novel. And I'd been and visited this brewery in the Cotswolds as I was looking for a location when I was working in drama. And it was just beautiful. It was crumbling little Cotswold buildings around a lake and a sort of a family that ran the brewery, very paternalistic. So they had 12 or so pubs. And I thought, this is like Ewing Oil, but in the Cotswolds. This is a perfect, perfect setting for a you know, family saga, commercial mm-hmm. women's fiction novel. So there we are. That was, so Honeycutt's my fictional Cotswold village, and that's Honeycutt Ales is the brewery, which is my Ewing Oil. Right. And I've got all the appropriate characters, the, you know.
And you've set a few books there, haven't you?
Yeah, I think there's three altogether. So there's a trilogy of books. Fantastic. Yeah.
And what's coming next?
What is coming next? I've got a little book coming out at Christmas. I set a book called The Beach Hut in a row of beach huts by the seaside. And the idea behind that is each beach hut has its own story. So rather than being a novel, it's kind of interconnected stories mm-hmm. in a row of beach huts by the seaside. And then I wrote The Beach Hut Next Door, similar sort of scenario. And now I'm doing Christmas at the Beach Hut, which is about a woman who runs away from Christmas, basically, because she just can't take the stress and the pressure and everybody messing her about and just goes, right, do you know what? I'm off.
I think a lot of people can relate.
I think a lot of people can, and that's why I wrote. But, of course, Christmas wins in the end. I'm not going to give away the ending, but, you know, we all have that moment of just thinking, oh, who needs it?
Yeah. But it's feel-good fiction, isn't it? It's fiction that, I mean, when I think of your books, they've always got bright, fun covers, always very inviting.
Yeah, I mean, you will hopefully feel uplifted by the end of it, but that's not to say that bad things don't happen, mm-hmm. because otherwise you don't have a story. You can't just write, everybody fell in love, la, 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 happy, happy, happy. You have to have high points and low points. So, you know, as I said earlier, I'm inevitably introducing my characters at a point of crisis, e.g. woman who can't stand it any longer and wants to run away from Christmas. And then you have to explore that further, make her problems bigger, twist them, and, you know, throw a bit more into the mix before you get your classic happy ending.
Okay. And what are the big inspirations for you? What was young Veronica reading in her teens?
Everything. Yeah, I read all the classics as a child. I was a bookworm. My father was in the army. We were dragged around the world every 2 years. We moved. And the one thing that was always the same was a library or a bookshop. So, and books kind of I could take them with me. So they were my friends. It sounds very tragic. So, you know, I did all the Laura Ingalls Wilder, all Frances Hodgson Burnett, Enid Blyton-ish. I wasn't that crazy, but all the classics. And then went through a hideous, pretentious phase of reading, you know, in French.
Camus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all of that. I thought I was right. Existential. And then I think then you go through the phase, when you start having children, that's kind of when I turned to commercial fiction. And, you know, I love and worship Jilly Cooper. I think she's just the most wonderful woman to walk the planet, because she's smart and she's clever and she's witty and she's well-read and she's a fantastic storyteller. But, you know, I think if you're a writer, you have to be a reader and you have to read broadly. Mm-hmm. You can learn as much from a bad book as you can from reading a good book. But that is, you know, don't go on a writing course, read. Just sit down and read and think, how has this writer made me turn the page? Yeah.
And what stuff are you reading at the moment?
Oh, God, I hate it when people ask that because I can't ever remember the answers. What am I reading? I get sent a lot of things, contemporary things. I've just read The Peacock Summer by Hannah Rachel. I'm only saying that because she's an Orion author too, but actually it's absolutely stunning, really beautiful. I love Hannah's writing. It's very twisty and turny and intriguing and beautiful.
Well, we'll end on that note. Thank you so much for speaking to us today, and looking forward to A Family Recipe being the smash hit of the summer.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thanks.
So a huge, huge thank you to Veronica for speaking to me. I know she was in the middle of a very, very busy day. It was the launch of her book, and her book is doing tremendously well. So we wish her all the best with that and in the future. And a big thank you to everyone who's got in touch via social media. We really love hearing from you. We had a great one from at BJ Scream, which is Brian Brunwood on Twitter. He says, woohoo, bestseller XP, reached a massive milestone. Finally caught up on you guys. Now to become a patron and get the deep dives. Is a writer's work never done? Should I be writing as well? Well, you know what? A writer's work probably never is done, but if you've reached a milestone, then take a moment to kick back and celebrate it and take it easy, you know? So thanks for that, Brian. We hope you have a fantastic time. And thank you for supporting us on Patreon as well. Do please join Brian. Go over to patreon.com/bestseller experiment. And support us on Patreon, because frankly, without your support, we wouldn't be able to continue with the podcast. And you get some amazing extras over there. You get to, if you're a chart topper, you get to join us on our live shows, and I'll be putting details of one of those up online very, very soon. You get early access to our shows. You get all sorts of fun extras. And talking about taking a break, we had a Twitter conversation with at Ink and Sage on Twitter, who says, you know, this morning I'm having a lot of trouble shaking this off. I did admin instead of writing. That counts, right? And we had a conversation where basically I said, you know, some days it just doesn't happen. You know, don't feel pressured to deliver gold every day. You know, it's some days it just doesn't work. So take a day off, you know, don't write. You don't have to write every day. I remember Sarah Bimber telling us this, you know, you can think about it. You don't necessarily have to be writing it. So kick back, take it easy, take the pressure off. You know, we are sometimes our worst critics, I think. But so Sage, so chill, relax. Take a rest day and then come back to it with fresh eyes. We had a lovely tweet from Richard Bat Brewster, who is at Bat Jutsu on Twitter. Since I keep failing to finish big projects, I'm relieved to have passed my short story about mage ascension to Richie Digital, at Richie Digital. So thanks to Bestseller XP for the regular inspiration to finish something. So thanks for that, Richard. Richard and Richie Digital have been listeners, I think, from pretty much the beginning. And it's great to hear your progress, guys. We love hearing about that. So good luck with that, and keep us posted on how you get on with that. And we had a lovely conversation between Dylan Hayes-Cross and Julian Barr and Dane Stark on Twitter. Just basically, we weren't involved. We were sort of tagged in all this, but they were talking about the community that we have online, the kind of people who are talking to each other and supporting each other in their projects and connecting writers, you know. So we are so happy to be a part of that, and we're so glad that you're all talking to each other and sharing ideas and supporting one another. And this is what this is all about for me. Thanks for keeping in touch. We're on Facebook, Bestseller Experiment. Twitter and Instagram is at Bestseller XP. We're also on Pinterest too, if you've got pretty pictures you want to show us. Now, at the time of recording, I am about to start packing my bags to go off to the RNA conference in Leeds, which is going to be a big adventure. I'm going to do a presentation about the podcast and hopefully meet a few of you there. So wish me luck, and I'll see you next time. Until then, happy writing.